at the man from nowhere. I want you to think about your life, what it was like 16 years ago. Maybe you can think about what age you were then and think, okay, what was going on in my life 16 years ago? How's it changed for the better or for the worse? We might just go to a blank now. 16 years ago, Eileen and I drove up the coast from Brisbane to Cairns and a bit beyond. And if you've driven up the coast from Brisbane to Cairns, one thing you'll know is you don't see the coast, at least not much. You have to drive halfway to Cairns before you get your first glimpse, a very fleeting glimpse of the sea. And then, if it's the right time of day, and if it's a sunny day, you drive over the crest of a hill, and there in the middle of nowhere, before you lies the broad expanse of the sparkling blue coral sea. And a bit off the highway, also in the middle of nowhere, is a solitary caravan park. And we were so captivated by that scene as we drove north after driving miles and miles through dry, sparse bushland, so captivated that on our return, we rang ahead to book a night in the caravan park. "Yes, love," said the voice on the phone. "Do you want an ordinary van or a deluxe van?" "How much is the deluxe van?" $39 a night. "We'll take the deluxe van." Imagine our surprise when on our return we reached the caravan park and we couldn't see the sea. In that part of the world, they have 8-metre tides. And in case you're wondering, around Brisbane, a very high tide is 2.5 metres. So when the tide goes out up there, it goes out. It goes out more than 1 kilometre across these shallow mud flats. It came in during the night, but because it was during the night, we didn't see it. And when we got up in the morning, it had gone out again. So we didn't see the sea the whole time we were there. I think the tide had gone out in the caravan park as well. The whole park had gone to seed. The inhabitants looked as though they had all gone to seed. Mostly they were single, older men, it appeared, of dubious background. They looked as though they had just run away from the French Foreign Legion, or maybe they were just seeking not to be found by the Australian Tax Office. But it did not look like a safe place to wander around at night, which you wouldn't want to do anyway, as there were crocodiles in the area. The deluxe van turned out to be a 1950s plywood van with a coat of faded blue paint. I asked the proprietress, I said to her, "So what's the difference between a deluxe van and an ordinary van?" And she said, "This one's got a TV." Which it did. It had a little 12-inch black and white TV on which you couldn't get reception. So that was our experience 16 years ago in the middle of nowhere. Now in Israel, 3,000 years ago, there was a similar community in the middle of nowhere. And in fact, that was the name of the place. The name of the place was Nowhere. In Hebrew, if you want, the Hebrew name was Lo Davar, which means nowhere, nothing. It was this, probably some trailer trash park, stuck out somewhere where you could run away to and hope no one would ever find you. And probably no one ever would. That's why it was called Nowhere. Even today, we don't know where Nowhere was. Best guess is that it was a long way from the administrative centre of Israel, which was down in the south around Jerusalem. And so it was probably up in the north. Some people think near the Sea of Galilee. Other people think right across the Jordan River. But no one knows for sure. And that was the way those who lived there liked it. Now, in this community of nowhere, there lived a young man. He was about 21 years of age. He had come there 16 years before. By now, at 21, he has a small son. Whether he's married, we don't know. We're not told anything about a wife. And he sits there, he's thinking about 16 years before, when he first arrived in that trailer trash caravan park. He has plenty of time to think. He doesn't have very much to do except to keep looking over his shoulder to make sure that no one turns up in the community who might recognise him. You see, 16 years ago, when he was only five back then, but 16 years before, he was the son of the Crown Prince. It was expected that when the king, who was this young man's grandfather, died, his father would succeed to the throne, and then one day he himself would be king. But there was another contender for the throne waiting in the wings, and it was always possible that the new contender would become king at some stage instead, and he would establish a new dynasty. But back 16 years before, that was all in the dim, distant future. His grandfather wasn't all that old. His father, the Crown Prince, was still young and sprightly. 16 years ago, when this young man was only five, he was being brought up in the palace, and it was all good. Then, tragically, there was a battle. Not with the contender for the throne who was waiting in the wings, but the battle was with the ancient enemies of Israel. His grandfather, the king, was killed. His father, the crown prince, also died in that battle. He himself was only five. The whole kingdom was thrown into turmoil. His nurse at the time, sensing trouble, picked him up in a hurry and fled the palace. Too much of a hurry, she dropped him and broke both of his legs. And he has been lame ever since. Sensing the young prince was in danger, the nurse took him and fled as far away from the palace as possible. She fled to a trailer trash park known only to a few, but known to those who did know it as nowhere. And there he had been living for the past 16 years. He wasn't completely destitute. Nearby lived a man who, I'm not sure how wealthy he was, but he took pity upon this son of the Crown Prince and he saw that he was provided for. But apart from that, he was doomed to eke out the remainder of his miserable existence in sad anonymity. You see, in the meantime, the contender had claimed the throne. He actually had every right to claim the throne because God had chosen him to be the lawful successor, and most people knew that by then. But at the time he claimed the throne, not all Israel was happy, not all Israel wanted to follow the new king, and instead they chose another son of the previous king. This was the young man's uncle, and they'd chosen him to reign instead. So for 7.5 years, there had been two kings in Israel. There had been the king that God had chosen, and there had been this young man's uncle who was a rebel king and the sworn enemy of the one chosen by God. After 7.5 years, the rebel, this young man's uncle, died. He was actually murdered in his bed by two of his servants. His part of the kingdom collapsed. There was now only one king who was the original contender, and everyone now turned to the contender and made him king over the whole of Israel. One kingdom, one king. That had all happened more than 8 years before. It's been 16 years since this young man went into hiding in exile in nowhere. And it's been 8 years since anyone from his own family dynasty sat on a throne. So now his life is more precarious than ever. You see, new dynasties don't like old dynasties, especially where there's already been one rebel from the old dynasty who's made a grab for power. There was only ever one solution, and that was to wipe out the old dynasty. One writer puts it this way, he says, it was solidification by liquidation. If you want to solidify the new dynasty, you've got to liquidate the old. Everybody knew that, everybody believed it, everybody did it. You can't afford to have two kings. You think about what happened, you know, when Jesus was born. You remember how the wise men came to King Herod? And they said, we've seen a sign that there's been a new king born. So what does King Herod do? He kills all the newborn babies around to make sure there is no new king. Solidification through liquidation. Everybody knew it. Everybody believed it. Everybody did it. You see the same thing in politics in this land, don't you? You know, you get a new leader. What does he do? He tries to assassinate the old leader, and the old leader tries to assassinate the new one politically, not physically. It's still solidification through liquidation. New leaders don't like old leaders. Old leaders don't like new leaders. So this man knows that, this young man knows that his life hangs by a thread. He's one of the last remaining members of the rebel dynasty, and his only hope is that no one finds him here in nowhere. Then one day, someone finds him. The new king finds him. A messenger comes from the new king saying, the new king wants to see you. The messenger comes with suitable backup to take him to the new king. After 16 years, the new king has found him. So how did this happen? Let's take it up in 2 Samuel chapter 9. Thanks. Now David said, David is the new king. He's the one who's been chosen by God. Now David said, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul? Saul was the old king. He was the grandfather of this young man we're talking about who lived in a place called Nowhere. Now David said, is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Jonathan was the crown prince. He was the son of the old king. He was the father of this young man living in a place called Nowhere. Now at first that sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, here is the new king. He wants to show kindness to a member of the old dynasty. And whatever happened to the policy of solidification through liquidation? Maybe this is a whole new approach. Maybe. But then again, if you want to find any members of the old dynasty, the rebel dynasty, you probably won't get far by saying, come out, come out, wherever you are, I want to kill you. You'll probably get further if you say, come out, wherever you are, I want to show you kindness, and then kill them. You're far more likely to succeed in killing them with kindness than with threats. You know, again, you remember Herod, when the wise men came and said, we've seen the sign, there's a new king who's been born. What did Herod say? You know, tell me where he is because I want to kill him. He didn't, did he? He said, tell me where he is that I may come and worship him. Tell me where he is that I may show him kindness. His plan was to kill the new king with kindness. So when David says, is there still anyone who's left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? No one can be too sure just what sort of kindness the king has in mind. Well, that's okay, because at this stage no one knows where there might be any remaining members of Saul's dynasty. But someone knows someone who might. Let's go to the next slide. There was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. So when they had called him, David the king said to him, are you Ziba? He said, at your service. Then the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? So David's sticking to his story here. He's saying the reason I want to find someone is because I want to show him kindness. In fact, he now brings religion into it, doesn't he? He makes it sound even better. He says, what I want to show is the kindness of God. That is the kind of kindness that God himself shows. Now, I don't know whether Ziba believes David or not, but he's in a spot. He knows it could go badly for him if he lies to the new king. And we also know from what we read some chapters further on in this book that Ziba's main concern in life is Ziba. He is more interested in self-preservation than the welfare of his master or the welfare of the former dynasty that he once served. So Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet. So the king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in a place called Nowhere," or Hebrew, Lo Debar. That's how the king found out. After 16 years, King David has discovered a surviving son of the crown prince. Let's go to the next one. Then King David sent and brought him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from a place called Nowhere. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, so this is the young man that we've been talking about who lived in Nowhere, his name was Mephibosheth. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. Then David said, "Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "Here is your servant." He comes to David's palace. He has no choice. He's terrified, not knowing what the new king, David, is plotting. He falls on his face and prostrates himself before the king. Okay, if this were a story on the internet, you know what would happen next. What happens next? Please don't click on what happens next if you see something on the internet. Bad things can happen. But in this case, we know what we expect to happen. We expect it's going to be solidification by liquidation. But twice now, David has said, "I'm looking to show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. I want to show him the kindness of God." David's looking to show kindness. He calls this kindness a special kind of kindness. He calls it the kindness of God. And he says he's especially looking to show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. In other words, for the sake of the father of this young man, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth's father was Jonathan. So what happens next? Thanks. So David said to him, "Do not fear. Do not fear." That's the first thing David tells this leftover relative of the previous dynasty. And of course, he's not just a leftover relative, is he? This is the son of the crown prince. So this is the next in line to the throne of the previous dynasty. He has a better claim to the throne than his uncle who rebelled against David did for 7.5 years. Do not fear. David knows Mephibosheth is afraid. And he knows that under normal circumstances, as the representative of a rebel dynasty that could claim the throne, Mephibosheth has good reason to fear. But instead, David says to him, "Do not fear." And then David says the most significant words that occur in this part of the Bible. "I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake." Let me explain two things there. What does he mean, "for Jonathan, your father's sake"? What David is doing there, he's referring to a covenant. He's referring to a binding agreement that he made with Jonathan 20 years before. That was before the battle. Of course, it was before the battle where Jonathan and Jonathan's father, the king, died. Long before that, for a long time, in fact, from the time that Jonathan and David first set eyes on each other, they had been best friends. Even after Jonathan came to realize that God had chosen David to be the next king and that he, Jonathan, would never succeed as king, God had chosen David for that role, even then, Jonathan's friendship with David didn't flinch. Not a scrap. They continued as best friends, knowing that Jonathan would never succeed his father to the throne. The one concern that Jonathan has was what would happen to his father, to his family, when David became king. He knew that at the time that his friendship with David was rock solid, and as long as they were both still alive, nothing would go wrong. But what if when the time came, David was no longer there? What then? I mean, Jonathan knew the drill. Solidification through liquidation. Everybody knew it. Everybody believed it. Everybody did it. So Jonathan asked David to make a covenant, a binding agreement with him. And he and David made a covenant that when David became king, he would look after Jonathan's family. At very least, he wouldn't kill them. And now, 20 years later, David is sticking to his word. The other thing I want to explain is this word, kindness. This is the third time that David has used that word to show that he wants to show kindness, not just to the family of Jonathan, but he says to the household of Saul. And it's interesting that David uses that word to describe what he wants to do in the same breath as he says he wants to do this for Jonathan's sake, that is, because of the covenant that he and Jonathan had made 20 years before. Because this word kindness in the original language where it occurs in the Bible nearly always occurs in the context of a covenant between two persons. In fact, you'll find some people even translate this word kindness as covenant love, or even, at very least, faithful love. This is the love that sticks faithfully by the one you love. Okay, the most obvious illustration today would be married love. In marriage, you enter into a covenant, you enter into a binding agreement with each other to hang in there and to love each other till death do you part. You will be faithful to each other. You will not give up on each other. This is not the Hollywood version of love where you lust for another's body for a few years and then you lust for another person's body for a few more years. No, this is faithful love, covenant love that commits to keeping your promise to love each other for life. So what David is saying to Mephibosheth here is that he wants to show Mephibosheth this loyal type of love that he's bound to show because of his previous covenant with Mephibosheth's father, Jonathan. Now, I'm not saying that David had no regard for Mephibosheth apart from this. I think it's very clear that David genuinely loved Mephibosheth. He pitied him in his weakness. He really did want to do him good. But he also wanted Mephibosheth to know that his love for him wasn't going to change tomorrow. David was bound by covenant to go on loving him this way. I mean, you can see that David really does love Mephibosheth. I mean, look at what he will do for him because he loves him. He says, I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually. So here is David. He's not just sticking to the bare minimum of the covenant he'd made with Jonathan and then think, okay, I've done my duty by him and now I'm out of here. I mean, the bare minimum of that covenant he made with Jonathan, all that it required was that he wouldn't kill Mephibosheth. Maybe supply him a little bit of food and send him on his way, but nothing more. You look at the covenant David made with Jonathan and nothing more was required than this. But covenant keeping in the Bible is never about simply doing the bare minimum required by the contract. Covenant keeping in the Bible is always bound up with covenant love. And covenant love is never about just doing the bare minimum. A marriage covenant is not about doing the bare minimum. You can't enter into a marriage covenant and say, okay, I don't have sex with other women and therefore I've been faithful to the covenant. Maybe I provided her a little bit for her upkeep, but that's all that's required. There's no covenant love there. And where there is no covenant love, you are not faithful to the covenant. David did way more than the bare minimum that his covenant with Jonathan required. He showed Mephibosheth kindness. He showed him covenant love. I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, which would have been quite extensive, and you shall eat bread at my table continually. Later on, he says, as for Mephibosheth, he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons. You see, David didn't just spare Mephibosheth's life. He doesn't just contribute a bit to his upkeep, but he says, he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons. He brings him into the family. He treats him as a child of the king. I want you to think about that. I want you to think about what David's doing here. This is how this chapter in the Bible concludes. As for Mephibosheth, he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate continually at the king's table, and he was lame in both his feet. That's the last thing we read. The Bible emphasizes that Mephibosheth was completely helpless. He's lame. He can't help himself. He's been living in a place called nowhere. He's a nobody from nowhere. He represents a rival, a rebel kingdom. But for the sake of his covenant, David, the rightful king, seeks him out. David spares his life. David welcomes him into his own home. David treats him like his own son. That is covenant love. Okay, let me wrap this up by reminding you where all this started. If you go right back to the beginning, David said, is there not someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? The kindness David showed was the kindness of God. The faithful love David showed was the faithful love of God. The covenant love David showed was the covenant love of God. David's inspiration, David's model was God. Think about that. You and I are lost. We live in a place called nowhere. Apart from Christ, we live our lives hiding from God, hoping that God will never find us. But God seeks us out. He comes looking for us. You and I are helpless, more helpless than Mephibosheth ever was. We are spiritually helpless. But Jesus came to help the helpless. In Jesus' day, Jesus' friend John the Baptist was arrested and put in prison. And as sometimes happens when you go through times of trial, as John the Baptist awaited trial and certain death, I mean the trial was going to be a farce, he started to have doubts as to who Jesus really was. So he sent to inquire, and Jesus sent back this message. Thanks. He said, go and tell John the things which you see, hear and see, the blind see, and the lame walk. The lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. The blind see, and the lame walk. Jesus came to heal the lame. He especially came to heal those who are spiritually lame, like you and like me. Jesus came to help the helpless. He came to help us who cannot help ourselves. In another part of the Bible, it says, when we were still without strength, Christ died for the ungodly. We were without strength because we were ungodly. We could not help ourselves. When we were still without strength, Christ died for the ungodly. More than that, we were God's enemies. We belonged to a rival kingdom, a rebel kingdom that opposed God. The Bible says, God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. If when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, much more having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. We were God's enemies. God had every reason to liquidate us as members of a rebel kingdom. But he didn't. Instead, he made a covenant with Jesus and he promised to save all those who put their faith in Jesus. He chose to save those who trust in Jesus because of the covenant he had made with him. So this is not God just doing the bare minimum that covenant requires. God loved us, it says, while we were still his enemies. I mean, the whole reason he made that covenant with Jesus in the first place was because he loved us. And in that covenant, he doesn't just promise not to destroy us. That would be the bare minimum. He promises to receive us into his household. He promises that we shall eat at his table. He promises to accept us as his own sons and daughters. As it says there, we are saved by his life, the life that Jesus gave for us on the cross. That is covenant love. That is the kindness of God. Do you know that love? Do you know that kindness? John Wesley didn't. Not when he was on the ship. He suddenly realized, here are a group of people who know the love of God, who know the kindness of God, and they're confident in God, and they can sing hymns in the middle of a storm. John Wesley didn't know that love. And you won't know it if you don't put your faith in Jesus, because God's covenant is with Jesus, and he saves us because of his covenant with Jesus. But if you put your faith in Christ, you can leave the nowhere where you are in life, and you can escape the decree of liquidation of God's enemies. You will be spared. But not only spared, you'll be received into God's own household, and you will be adopted as his own son or daughter, and you shall eat at his table. Amen. Are there any questions? Yes, Michael.
So, from this fellowship, we, I guess, got to really see, you got to then eat at the king's table and see that. Do you have any tips for, it can be hard, like we know these things, that we get to, I guess, sit at the king's table and stuff, but sometimes we don't feel that, and sometimes it doesn't, because a lot of these are promises to come. Do you have any tips from your own life, perhaps, that keeps you going in times when you don't feel like that, when we don't feel like we're at King's Table or anything?
Yeah. Okay, first of all, yes, there are promises to come, and you're thinking ahead to heaven, to glory, when we shall sit with Christ at his table. Even now, in a way, we do sit with Christ at his table, because, you know, Jesus talked about feeding upon him, having fellowship with him even now. So, I mean, that is a reality even now, even though it's a fairly pale shadow compared to what waits for us. I think everyone goes through times, all Christians, I mean, go through times when they might be assailed by doubts. I mean, you think of John the Baptist. Here he is, he's the chief supporter of Jesus. He really believes in Jesus. When he's thrown into prison, he goes through a time of depression and despair and begins to think, oh, is Jesus really who he says he is? And then the way Jesus answers that is by saying, okay, just think about what's happening here. Think about who I am. Think about what I'm doing. And I think that's probably one of the best things to do when you have fears and doubts and go through times of depression. You begin to doubt that Jesus is really who he is. Just go back to what you know about Jesus and what he has done. And one of the verses that really helps me is in Romans chapter 8, where it says, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him freely give us all things? You know, when things are going wrong in my life and there's a few storms around, I've got to think, okay, let's get this in perspective. What has God actually done for me? God has actually given me his own son, and his own son has died for me. And that tends to get everything in perspective, because nothing can compare to that. Why would God, who created you and you've rebelled against him, why would he give up his own son? Why would he even love you? Because he didn't just love you because Christ came. It was his love that sent Christ in the first place. Why would he even love you? I could never get my head around that, honestly. Why would God, who is this great God who made me, and I'm a creature of his, and I've rebelled against him, why would he do that? That does help to get everything in perspective, even though I can't understand why God would do that. Sorry, I'm not sure whether that's right. All right, if you've got any other questions, please talk to one of us afterwards.